The Blaze Radio Network. On demand. Glenn Beck.
You know, we have to start comparing ourselves to ourselves yesterday and stop comparing ourselves to the things that we see on television or on Facebook, because it's a lie. David and Louise loved each other. Oh, and they loved Elvis. It was clear from their family Facebook page. You see the pictures on their Facebook page, their three vow renewal ceremonies. They had a tradition of going to the Elvis Chapel in Las Vegas. David, Louise, and their 13 children. Oh, and the king. All look very happy in these photos. Every Facebook page lies. Sometimes just by omission. Sometimes you're not getting the whole picture. Sometimes you're getting a complete fraud. Today, you're looking at the Turpin's images in a whole different light. And now they look dark and twisted. If you don't know who the Turpins are, let me tell you. Sunday, authorities responded to a 9/11 call by one of David and Louise's daughters. The daughter frantically explained on this stolen phone that she had escaped the family home and begged the police to come and rescue her and her siblings, who were starving and chained to their beds. The girl claimed to be 17 years old. When police actually saw her, they didn't believe her. They thought she was 10. But she is 17. They found the girl's 12 brothers and sisters chained, padlocked to their beds. They were filthy. They were emaciated. The children, they thought, were all under the age of 15. But they weren't. The children ranged in age from 2 to 29. They were so famished that they were shocked. The deputies were shocked to find out that 7 of them were adults. David and Louise were unable to immediately provide a logical reason to why their children might have been, you know, chained to their bed. I'm trying to think. As I read that this morning, I thought, what would the logical reason be to chain your children to the bed? But they apparently had none. The children were taken to the hospital. They're in the care of Child Protective Services. The Turpins were arrested. They were booked on charges of torture and child endangerment. We're at a time when we have so much information about almost everything. Accept what is true. In the age of social media, it is getting more and more difficult to know what's real and what isn't. Because we all have the ability to edit and manipulate our own narratives. You know, I don't know if you saw the movie about P.T. Barnum, The Greatest Showman. But I left that movie and I thought, I want to read about P.T. Barnum. So I went, and there's just not a lot of good books about him. The one that gets the highest ratings, the one that is supposedly the best, the author was P.T. Barnum. How could I possibly believe anything that P.T. Barnum said about himself? He was trying to give an image of himself that wasn't necessarily reality. And isn't that what we're doing with Facebook? Because of Facebook, Turpin's friends and family had no idea that they were hideous monsters who were torturing their children. What's really frightening is they're not the only ones. This isn't going to be the first time. It's not going to be the last time. We'll continue to be shocked by the dichotomy of how people present themselves and what the actual truth is. How many people are we finding out are monsters? The Turpin family provides us with a horrible cautionary tale today. Something that we all need to understand as we move forward. And it is just really simple, but somehow or another, at times, it controls our life. It even controls our own attitude and self-worth, because we forget that when it comes to social media, you're not seeing the full picture, and sometimes you're not even anywhere close to the truth.
It's Tuesday, January 16th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
So I got up this morning and I saw this Turpin story, and my first thought was, what the hell's wrong with us? What happens to human beings? What is happening to us? And I guess nothing. We're not getting worse. If anything, maybe we're getting better. But this was, this was the way of the world when, you know, in the Dark Ages and when people were not living on top of each other, this kind of stuff, you know, happened a lot. We just hide it now, and hopefully we're getting better.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, hopefully it's not quite as common. But I mean, I guess these stories probably did happen. We're hearing about them now. It's weird that, because when the story first broke, you think to yourself, oh yeah, that's like one of those, like this story or that story or that story. And you're like, why do I have other examples of this?
Yeah.
I shouldn't have any other examples to point to. This should be a one-time thing, but it's not. These things do exist.
It's not something that is new.
No.
I mean, you know, the story of St. Nicholas, one of the reasons why he was deemed a saint is because of the miracle of the four boys. I can't remember exactly what it's called. There were these boys that went from their house. They were supposed to go to their uncle's house or something, and they were halfway there. They stopped at this inn, and this guy who ran the inn said, oh yeah, you guys can stay here. You can stay here for free. I just need some help downstairs. Went downstairs. He killed them. He ground them up into sausage, and he was making meat pies for the people who came to his place. That's what the meat was. It wasn't cats. It was kids. St. Nicholas was the bishop of the town, knew those children. He went on a search for the kids, stopped at this inn, sensed that something was really wrong, went down into the basement, saw the condition. He was canonized because they say that he rose, he assembled them back together somehow or another and brought them back from the dead. I don't know about that part of the story. That's the kind of stuff that, you know, people have been doing to people forever.
Yeah. You know, that's a weird, dark part of humanity, isn't it? I guess, you know, it's hard to understand how you could get to that position. Like, first you have to make that decision. It's like, you know, the first person who ever drank milk. You're like, what was the decision that led to that?
Milk.
Who was like, hey, I'll suck off clams. That cow thing.
I think clams or oysters or lobsters are like, what? You know, somebody had to try to eat a spider at one point. I mean, a big hairy spider. And they were like, oh, okay, that's not good. Don't know.
Right. And decisions, like,
yeah,
when
don't
you
know.
Make that first decision, it influences the rest of your decisions.
Yes.
And it doesn't catch on with humanity.
Yes.
It seems like that's, most of us are not enslaving people. And that's really positive. But like, you start that. That family at some point made a decision for that first kid to be chained up in a room. And that lasted for how long, and how many more people were affected by it? They continued to go down that road. Maybe they didn't think they could reverse it. Maybe they're so psychotic that that's all they wanted kids for. I we're going to find out a lot
it's
about this
weird
story.
Because there's all these pictures of them happy.
Yeah.
And some of the kids were out. They were seen, you know, as early as a couple of weeks ago, one of the older ones driving a car going out. I mean, the fear of what would happen, I guess, to the rest of the family must have been incredible.
Yeah, yeah. You hit on an interesting point in the monologue, because I think most people are just going to take this to, you know, how horrible the situation is, which is true. But, I mean, we take Facebook pictures seriously for some reason, right? It's the same way my wife, every time a new product comes out and that she wants to buy, she comes and shows me the testimonial page of their website. Like, to me, there's no impact at all from a testimonial page from a website, because I know you have an incentive of this company. They're trying to sell it to me. Of course, they found the 9 people who really like the product, or they made them up, right? Like, that's how I internalize that. And I think a lot of people do same thing with Facebook. I don't know. I look at Facebook and people are, you know, smiling photos. And I think internally for most people, you just be like, oh, wow, they must have a really good life. What they are all happy. They're having these wonderful times together. What a great story. And we all know that at some level, not to the level where you're chaining your children to the beds, hopefully, but we all at some point, we don't post the really sad pictures. We don't take pictures when people are mourning. We don't take pictures when people are fighting and are having troubled times. You take pictures when things are happy. You post them. You are doing the same editing bubble stuff we complain about with the news, right? Like, you're only exposing people to the happy points of your life. And the fact that that could work on people to the level to separate a family from happiness to kids chained up to their beds shows how powerful that is. I mean, their own relatives weren't even questioning it.
Well, there's something wrong with the relatives, too. I mean, the grandparents live in West Virginia. They said they hadn't seen the kids in 5 years, hadn't seen the family in 5 years. But they said, you know, the last couple of years, they've talked to the family lots of times. However, never the grandchildren. Well, what? I mean, doesn't that strike you as weird that you have grandchildren from 2 to 29? And over a 2-year period, you've talked to people in the house, but never the children?
It is weird, but I mean, family dynamics can be strange sometimes. Sometimes there's fights, there's long-term battles, there's, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that happens in families where it's possible that could happen. You'd think, though, there'd be some indication of trouble.
And it's frightening as well. If you look at the aerial shots of this house, these houses are, you know, not acres apart. They're right on top of each other. Neighbors said they didn't even know that, some of them didn't even know that there were 13 kids in there. What? What? Wow. You didn't even know. What the one neighbor said they thought it was weird, but I think 2 weeks ago, she went outside at night, and it was like 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and the kids were, there were 4 of them, and they were all kneeling down in the grass together, and they were all just kind of rolling around in the grass. And the mother was standing in the back watching over them. And she cried over the fence, you know, the neighbor did, said, "Hey, hey, guys." And the kids kind of looked at her and then just kind of froze. And the mother didn't even recognize the neighbor saying anything. And she said it was just really odd, but she didn't think anything about it. It just, you know, it's weird that they were out at 9:30 at night, but, you know, and their reaction is weird.
Well, we just have no, I mean, the people on my street could have, you know, entire tribes in their basement and I wouldn't even know. I mean, you don't interact with your neighbors like you used to. I mean, we always throw back to the times where you used to be able to just let your kids out and they would go around the neighborhood, and now we'd be terrified to do those things, right? Like, you'd never want that to happen. Because we're sort of somewhat crazy, right? Like, the crime rates are all lower. There's no reason to, we're overprotective now with our kids. But part of the reason why it felt okay is because you knew everybody in the neighborhood. You knew all the other parents. You knew that they would look out for your kids. You knew that they would feel okay punishing them if they did something wrong.
I think it was also more than that, though. We thought we all had the same values.
Yeah.
We were wrong. You know what I mean?
We're totally misled.
Right. We were totally misled, but we all thought we had the same basic values. And so we didn't question the parents because we thought, oh, well, you know, parents are parents. They believe the same thing we do, and they're going to make sure. No, And I don't know if anything has changed because, I mean, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, so, you know. But I remember me and my friends going over to my friend's house, and my friends, we were all embarrassed for the kid whose parents were hippies and were always stoned. And we were like, oh, your mom and dad stoned again? Yeah. And they would be like, you know, hey, kids, how are things? You know? And, I mean, my parents didn't know that I was going over to, you know, I happened to be running with a group of decent kids that were all like, okay, the stoners are here. But we all turned out to be stoners. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And part of it is because our parents were radically different. My parents would not have been cool with that. But my parents just thought everybody's parents were the same. They didn't realize, oh, that's the 60s hippie family. Yep. Mm.
Glenn Beck.
Have a fascinating conversation next hour with a guy who can tell you a little bit what the future is going to be like in a very entertaining way. We will take you there next hour.
This terrible story, too, about these kids that were chained in the basement. And that's the big story today about this Turpin family. When you were reading the story, did you have a moment at all, like I did, thinking about Hank Johnson? Remember Hank Johnson, the congressman? And so he asked the military guy, do you think if we put too many troops in Guam, you know, the whole thing will, you know, tip over and capsize?
Yeah.
And if you remember his response, it was, we don't anticipate that.
Right.
And there's just something about the way that, like, officials respond to these things that's just in the most serious circumstance is really funny. And so in this one, they went and they interviewed or it was a police statement where they were talking about this terrible case, 13, you know, kids, and they're all like chained up in a basement and this inexplicable, these old, you know, 20-year-olds that look like 10-year-olds because they're so thin. And they asked him what happened. And he said, and the quote was, David and Louise were unable to immediately provide a logical reason why their children were restrained in that matter.
Right.
They were. What would the logical reason
be? I know.
Be?
I know.
That is such a great quote. They were unable to immediately come up with a logical reason why they changed.
I'll give you time on that. I'll give you a couple hours.
Take a couple hours.
The week. Can you come up with a logical reason to chain your kids to the bed?
I can't come up with it. I gotta say, I mean, let's see. If there was a, you were worried about them escaping because there was a nuclear holocaust outside.
Nope.
No, I don't think that would work.
You thought they were possessed by the devil.
Nope. No.
They were violent to themselves and others.
Nope. They wanted to be prepared if gravity reversed itself.
That could happen.
That
could happen.
At any moment.
At any moment, they could be floating up. Well, they wouldn't have floated away if they would have. All they would have to do is close the windows.
Everyone else would have fallen. Well, yeah, that's true. You would have hit the ceiling.
Just close the windows. I got to pull them down from the ceiling again.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
This Aziz Ansari story is really where what's going to separate the men from the boys, the revolutionaries from the sane. Margaret Atwood, she's the woman who wrote A Handmaid's Tale. She's been a feminist for forever. She is now, I think, 78 years old, and she wrote this article for The Guardian last week, entitled "Am I a Bad Feminist?" So I read this yesterday, and I read the whole thing, not just the highlights like everybody else, and I read the whole thing. She said, "It seems like I'm a bad feminist, and I can add that to the other things that I've been accused of since 1972, such as climbing to fame up a pyramid of decapitated men's heads," from a lefty journal. Being a dominatrix bent on the submission of men, a right one. Of being an awful person who can annihilate with her magic white witch powers anyone critical of her at Toronto dinner tables. She said, "I'm so scary, aren't I? And now it seems I'm conducting a war on women. Like the misogynistic, rape-enabling, bad feminist that I am. My fundamental position is that women are human beings with the full range of saintly and demonic behaviors this entails, including criminal ones. Women are not angels incapable of wrongdoing. If they were, we wouldn't need a legal system. Nor do I believe that women are children incapable of agency or making moral decisions. If they were, we're back to the 19th century and women should not own property, have credit cards, have access to higher education, control their own reproduction, or vote. There are powerful groups in North America pushing this agenda, but they're not usually considered feminists. Furthermore, I believe that in order to have civil and human rights for women, there have to be civil and human rights, period, including the right to fundamental justice. Just as for women to have the vote, there has to be a vote. Do good feminists believe that only women should have such rights? Surely not. That would be a flip of the coin on the old state of affairs, which in which only men had those rights. So let me suppose that my good feminist accusers and the bad feminists, that is me, agree on the above points. Where do we diverge? How did I get into such hot water with good feminists? In November 2016, I signed as a matter of principle, as I have signed many petitions, an open letter called UBC Accountable. This is the University of British Columbia. She goes into how the University of British Columbia treated one of its former employees, Stephen Galloway. He was the former chair of the Department of Creative Writing. He was accused of something. He wasn't even allowed to know what he was accused of. They did this inquiry. They had multiple witnesses and interviews. Finally, a judge said there was no sexual assault. Yet he got fired anyway. His life was destroyed, and she's looking at this going, no, this is not, this is a witch hunt. This is a witch hunt. She said any fair-minded person would withhold judgment as to guilt until the report and the evidence is available for us to see. But this is witch talk, and she talks about going into now these witch trials, and we've got to stop. We can't have the witch trial justice. Now, another feminist writes, because Margaret Atwood was called a blood-drinking monster, the things that they said about her were just horrendous. So another woman writes, and she says, Margaret Atwood, as an enemy of feminism, is a tough concept to get your head around. She is, after all, the author of The Handmaid's Tale, the universally acclaimed dystopian fantasy in which men are women are enslaved to men. Her impressive body of work, one that has profoundly informed the feminist zeitgeist, is a 50-year-long attack on misogyny and the patriarchal state. Ms. Atwood is probably the leading feminist author in the world. So what happened? Now listen to this. What happened is that the revolution has entered a new phase. Having vanquished the reactionary, the Jacobins are now sending the moderates to the guillotine. Buildings have to be raised so society can begin anew, and everyone who isn't for them is against them. Moderates like Ms. Atwood and their odious ideas about due process and the presumption of innocent until proven guilty are traitors to the revolution. In one letter to the Globe, it put it another way. Revolution isn't about justice. It's about change. This is a frightening thing to behold. We as a society are now starting to go into a new period of this revolution. It was not about justice. It was about change. What did we say in 2007, 2008? Change to what? Change to what? Nobody would ever define the change. And so this revolution now has happened. And now the revolutionaries are taking everyone kicking and screaming. And these are the same people who said George Bush was horrible because he said, if you're not with us, you're against us. That was a horrible thing. That's what they're saying now. And there's this standard that is, it has nothing to do with human rights. It's against human rights. This Aziz Ansari, this story is remarkable. And even Ashley Banfield, who I don't think I've ever agreed with anything she's ever said, she gets on CNN, and I want you to listen to what she said about this.
What you have done, in my opinion, is appalling. You went to the press with the story of a bad date, and you have potentially destroyed this man's career over it, right after he received an award for which he was worthy. If you were sexually assaulted, go to the cops. If you were sexually harassed, jeopardizing your work, speak up and speak out loud. But by your own descriptions, that is not what happened. You had an unpleasant date, and you did not leave. That is on you. And all the gains that have been achieved on your behalf and mine are now being compromised by the allegations that you threw out there. And I'm going to call them reckless and hollow. I cannot name you publicly and sentence you to a similar career hit as Ansari because you chose to remain anonymous. Lucky you.
Wow. Wow. I mean, geez, if a guy said that, their career would be over, right?
Oh, if a guy said that?
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you some other things. You know, babe.com is the rag that put this charge out.
Right. From the unnamed source.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who had a bad date. Explain exactly what happened.
They went to his apartment, started the date at the apartment. They had met at a party, and she was impressed by his celebrity. I mean, if you don't know who he is, he's a comedian. He does the show Master of None on Netflix, among other things. And so they went to his apartment. At one point, he offered her a glass of wine, and he brought her white wine. And in the article, it was an interesting, revealing moment where she says, it was white wine. Of course, I prefer red. Like, as if she couldn't say, can I have some red wine? It was like he was forcing her to accept this white wine, even though she preferred red. And it's like such a strange detail to put in there, just showing that.
If it is true that he didn't want you to have white wine and you said, no, I prefer white, she'll have the red, that should have been the end of the date right there.
Right, and that's not what happened. She didn't even express, by her own telling, that she actually wanted red wine. She just accepted the white wine. And again, it's another part of she has no agency. She's not a person. She's, you know, she is an underling in society. She can't make her own decisions. She can't express her own wants and desires. So they go out. They have a quick date. They go through, as she puts it, they rush through a dinner at a fancy restaurant. Now, so far, this guy's given her wine, and he's brought her to a fancy restaurant. There's no indication he's been a jerk to her in any way. They get back. They start kissing. They eventually perform oral sex on each other.
Which she said she was uncomfortable with. Okay. But then she left. She came back. And they did it again.
Right. And so she claims through this, she gave nonverbal cues that which should have told him to stop. At one point, she did say something like, I kind of want to take it slow when it came to the final act, right? Like, it seemed like, by her description, she had drawn some sort of line that she didn't want to go all the way that night. And she tried at one point, she said, let's take it a little slow. They stopped. They started up again. And it got close to that point again. She decided, you know, I don't want to do this. And she left. He did not say, no, you will do this. I demand it. When she asked to slow down, he slowed down.
And she left.
And he was so sure that this was a consensual, fine evening, even though he wanted to have sex with her and she decided to stop it at one level. That the next day he texted her and said, hey, it was really nice meeting you last night. I had a great time. And then she responded with this 100 word text of, I did not feel fine and here's why. And she was very upset. He responded and said, oh my God, I had no idea you felt that way. I'm really sorry if you felt that way. I feel terrible. And that was it until she decided to write an article anonymously about the incident.
Okay, so she writes anonymously and babe.com. Now, I've never heard of babe.com, but you know who has? Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch put $6 million into babe.com. He was one of the first big investors of babe.com. Hmm. The average writer is about 25 years old, female. Now, you said a minute ago, imagine if a woman or a man said what Ashley Banfield just said.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me give you a couple of the stories, and I can't read very much of these stories because they're absolutely pornographic. Okay. From babe.com by Carolyn Finney. The headline is How to Trap Your Man Who Doesn't Know He's Your Man, but is still your man before Valentine's Day.
Okay. Hmm.
Now imagine if I said, hey, I'm going to write an article about how to trap that woman who doesn't know she's your girlfriend, but she's your girlfriend until Valentine's Day.
Yeah, the men writing articles about trapping women, it doesn't go over that well, typically.
Yeah, yeah. Cuffing season is officially over, which means your current victim is crafting a convenient excuse to leave you before the big day of Valentine's Day. Your current victim. Imagine I write that.
Mm. Writing that you have female victims, not usually looked upon kindly.
Kindly, right.
When men write that. Sort
and
of
who can blame them? Now listen to this. Who can blame them? You know you're manic, but you thought your game would make up for it. Nevertheless, 3 to 5 meltdowns and half a breakup later, he's weary and you're mad. And he's still not sure why you think you're dating him in the first place. This is only one.
The stuff you can't read, which you read to me, and I'm internally scarred from you reading to me today.
It's just it's stunning.
Yeah, it is stunning. And it's what's amazing about it is it's all written from this perspective of, oh, gosh, we're feminists. We can do anything. We're in control of our sexuality. Look at us. And then she can't say no to red wine at the same time.
This talks about how you trap a man in bed, how you get him to do what you want him to do by fooling him and trapping him.
Mm-hmm.
So please, please, babe.com, don't lecture the rest of us on how to behave. Because if I behaved this way, forget my daughter, if I behaved the way you are condoning and encouraging, you would have the right to describe me as a despicable human being.
And by the way, babe.net is the site.
Yeah, okay.
Don't try the other one.
Oh, don't try the other one. Okay, sorry. Sorry about that. Whoops.
Glenn Beck.
See, there's a new app out now that allows you to create a consent contract before you sleep with somebody.
I like this. This is now we can all have it all official.
Yeah. You just, you know what? Sign here, sign here, initial this, and sign, and I'm hot and ready to go now.
It's not sexy, but also, aren't you giving away? Like, can you imagine if you actually got really assaulted after this? The person would have a legally binding contract saying you agreed. That would not.
Well,
that's not a good move.
That'd be a form contract.
Okay.
You need the long extended version.
Mercury.